A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been watching the US-Iran negotiations unfold from Jerusalem, and he zeroed in on a moment that a lot of people missed. Marco Rubio, on the sidelines of Air Force One, it's asked something about genocide. And without missing a beat, he pivots and says Iran is the master of genocide, then proceeds to name every proxy Iran has activated across the Middle East. Daniel's reaction watching that was, quote, "This guy gets it in a way I don't feel about Vance, certainly." And his question for us is, who is Rubio? What shaped his worldview? And how does his hawkishness sit as a counterpoint to Trump and Vance in these negotiations?
That Air Force One moment is the perfect entry point, because it wasn't a prepared statement. It was a reflex. Someone asks about genocide, and Rubio's instinct isn't to talk about human rights in the abstract or issue a diplomatic condemnation. It's to name the network. Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, Shia militias in Iraq and Syria. He listed them like he was reading off a roster. That's not something you can fake in the moment. That's someone whose mental map of the Middle East is built around the proxy architecture.
Daniel's instinct that Rubio gets something Vance doesn't, that's worth sitting with, because Vance has been all over the map on this. He chastises Israel for trying to, in his words, kill its way out of wars, which sounds like a critique of military force as a tool. But then, in the same breath, he's threatening Iran that violence will be met with violence. It's a contradiction that doesn't seem to bother him.
It's a contradiction that suggests his position isn't fully formed. And that's fine for a senator who's one voice among 100. It's less fine for the Vice President of the United States during nuclear negotiations with a regime that has spent 40 years perfecting the art of strategic ambiguity.
The puzzle Daniel's pointing at is this. The Trump administration is not a monolith on Iran. You got Trump himself, who wants a deal, a great deal, in his framing, something he can sell as peace through strength. You've got Vance, who's philosophically conflicted about military force, but still brandishes it rhetorically. And then you've got Rubio, the Secretary of State, who seems to believe the entire framework of negotiating with this Iranian regime is fundamentally flawed. Three men in the same administration, three different theories of how the world works, and the negotiations are at a critical phase right now. Mid-2022-26, the pressure is mounting, and Rubio is the wild card.
He's the wild card because he's not just a cabinet secretary implementing the president's policy. He's a former presidential candidate with his own foreign policy worldview that predates Trump and, in important ways, conflicts with Trump's transactional approach. And he's almost certainly thinking about 2028. Every public appearance, every carefully chosen word, every micro-expression, people are reading it all through the lens of what comes next.
Which brings us to the body language. There's been analysis circulating, Daniel mentioned it, of Rubio in these joint appearances with Trump and Vance. Lip compression, delayed responses, averted gaze at key moments. The kind of tells that suggest someone who's holding something back.
The question is whether he's holding back genuine frustration with the direction of policy, or whether he's performing frustration for an audience of donors and primary voters who want a serious foreign policy alternative to Trumpism. It could be both. It usually is both in politics.
To understand what's actually happening in these negotiations, and what might happen next, we need to understand the man. Where Rubio came from, what formed him, why he sees Iran the way he does, and how his worldview collides with Trump's and Vance's in real time. Because the outcome of this negotiation, deal or no deal, diplomacy or confrontation, may depend less on what happens in the negotiating room than on the unresolved tensions between the three Americans sitting on the other side of the table.
That's where the biography becomes essential. Rubio is not a generic Republican hawk. He's the son of Cuban exiles who fled Castro in 1956. He was raised in a political culture that views engagement with dictatorships not as naive, but as morally complicit. That's not a talking point for him. It's the air he breathes growing up in Miami.
Let's start there. Let's start with the bartender and the maid who left Cuba before the revolution fully consolidated, and the son who grew up to become the most consequential Secretary of State in a generation, and the one figure in the room who seems to believe, with genuine conviction, that Iran cannot be negotiated with.
That's where the Cuban exile experience becomes more than just biography. It's a political inheritance. Rubio was born in Miami in 1971, but the world he grew up in was still shaped by the generation that lost Cuba. His father worked as a bartender, his mother as a maid. They weren't political exiles in the sense of being former government officials or dissidents. They were working-class people who fled a revolution that was devouring everything. And in that community, the lesson was unambiguous. You don't negotiate with regimes that see your existence as an ideological affront. You don't make deals with people whose stated goal is your elimination.
Which is why when Rubio looks at Iran, he doesn't see a rational state actor that can be brought into the community of nations through incentives. He sees the Castros with Persian characteristics, a regime whose founding purpose is the export of revolution and the destruction of Israel, and that treats diplomatic agreements as tactical pauses, not binding commitments.
That's not just projection on his part. The Iranian regime's own rhetoric supports that reading. Death to America isn't a metaphor in Tehran, it's state policy expressed as a chant. The difference is that most American politicians treat that as bluster. Rubio treats it as a statement of intent. His 2015 floor speech opposing the JCPOA wasn't about the technical details of centrifuges and breakout times. It was about the nature of the regime itself. He called it a historic mistake that will enable a nuclear-armed Iran, and his argument was that you cannot build a verification regime strong enough to constrain a state that views deception as a legitimate tool of asymmetric warfare.
When Daniel watches Rubio on Air Force One and thinks this guy gets it, what he's responding to is a worldview that takes ideological commitments seriously. Most Western foreign policy analysis assumes all actors are fundamentally rational and self-interested in ways that can be modeled and negotiated with. Rubio's Cuban-American formation tells him that some actors are ideologically committed in ways that make negotiation not just difficult, but dangerous, because it buys them time and legitimacy while they advance their actual goals.
That's the fault line inside this administration. Trump thinks he can do a deal because he believes every counterparty has a price. Vance seems to think the problem is tactical, that Israel is over-reliant on force when it should be doing something else, though he's never quite specified what the something else is. Rubio thinks the entire framework is wrong because the regime's ideology makes it an unreliable negotiating partner by definition. Three men, three theories of the world, sitting on the same side of the table while the centrifuges keep spinning. The thing is, his position hasn't really evolved. That's what's striking when you trace the arc. Most politicians shift with the political winds. Rubio's Iran stance in 2015 sounds almost identical to his Iran stance today. After Iran's proxy attacks on U.S. bases in Syria in 2024, his response was basically a condensed version of that JCPOA speech. The only thing Iran understands is strength, and we have not shown it. Same argument, same cadence, same underlying theory of the regime.
Which means this isn't a posture he adopted when he became Secretary of State. It's not even a posture he adopted when he ran for president in 2016. It predates all of that. And that consistency is worth noting because it means his current friction with Trump and Vance isn't tactical. It's structural. He genuinely believes something different about the nature of the adversary.
And to understand why, you have to understand the political culture of the Cuban exile community in Miami. This wasn't a community of people who left voluntarily for economic opportunity. They were pushed out by a revolution that nationalized their property, imprisoned dissidents, and made political opposition a capital offense. The exile community's defining political commitment was that you don't compromise with regimes that don't recognize your right to exist. That's not a policy preference, it's a moral axiom.
When Rubio entered politics in Florida, elected to the State House in 2000, became Speaker in 2006, he was already carrying that framework. His 2010 Senate run tapped into Tea Party energy, which was mostly about domestic spending and limited government, but Rubio's foreign policy was never isolationist. He was a traditional Republican interventionist from day one, supported the Iraq War, supported a muscular posture toward adversaries. The Tea Party gave him the grassroots momentum, but his foreign policy DNA came from a completely different lineage.
Then 2016 happens. Rubio runs for president as a hawk, more aggressive on Russia, more aggressive on China, more skeptical of diplomatic engagement than anyone else on that debate stage, except maybe, ironically, Ted Cruz. Trump's America First platform was the antithesis of everything Rubio was arguing for. Trump called the Iraq War a disaster. Trump suggested maybe NATO had outlived its purpose. Trump talked about getting along with Putin, and Rubio lost. His own state of Florida rejected him in the primary.
That's the moment a lot of politicians would have reinvented themselves. And Rubio did pivot in some ways. He made peace with Trump, endorsed him, worked with the administration when he could. But here's the thing. His voting record on Iran never wavered. He supported the Soleimani strike in 2020 when plenty of Republicans were nervous about escalation. He kept making the same argument about the regime's ideological nature. The pivot was political, not philosophical.
Which brings us to the body language. When you watch Rubio standing next to Trump while the president talks about the great deal he's going to make with Iran, you see it. The lip compression is the classic tell. It's what people do when they're physically restraining themselves from speaking. The delayed response when a reporter asks a question that he knows he'd answer differently. The averted gaze at moments when Trump or Vance says something that, from Rubio's perspective, fundamentally misunderstands the adversary.
The open question is whether that's genuine internal conflict leaking out, or whether it's a performance. Because Rubio is almost certainly running for president again in 2028, every signal he sends now, verbal and nonverbal, is being read by donors, by primary voters, by the party apparatus that will decide what post-Trump Republicanism looks like.
It could be both. The most effective political signaling is usually grounded in something real. If Rubio believes the administration's approach is naive, then letting that frustration show, just enough, never enough, to be accused of disloyalty, is the smartest play available to him. He gets to be the loyal soldier who's also the grown-up in the room who understands things the others don't.
For someone watching from Jerusalem, like Daniel, the distinction probably doesn't matter much. What matters is that when the president and vice president talk about making a deal, the Secretary of State's face tells a different story. And in a negotiation where Iranian negotiators are surely watching every frame of American body language for signs of division, that's not nothing. It's intelligence.
The proxies he named on Air Force One, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, the Shia militias in Iraq, those aren't abstractions to him. They're the mechanism by which Iran has spent decades projecting power without triggering the kind of full-scale war that would invite devastating retaliation. Every one of those proxies serves a dual purpose. They advance Iranian interests regionally, and they provide Tehran with deniability. Rubio understands that architecture in granular detail. And his critique of any nuclear deal is that it leaves that architecture intact, which means Iran gets sanctions relief and legitimacy while continuing to wage asymmetric war through its network.
That's the core of his disagreement with the deal framework. It's not about enrichment levels or inspection regimes. It's about whether you can make a meaningful agreement with a state whose entire regional strategy is built on deniable warfare through proxies. Rubio's answer is no. Trump's answer appears to be that you can, if the deal is good enough. And Vance. Vance seems to be trying to hold both positions simultaneously, which is where the contradictions start to show.
Vance's contradictions are where this gets revealing. His quote, the exact phrasing, was that Israel cannot kill its way out of wars. That's a statement that, on its face, sounds like a critique of military force as a tool. It could have come from a progressive think tank. It suggests a belief that violence is self-defeating, that it breeds more violence, that there's a political solution that force can't achieve.
Then he turns around and threatens Iran that violence will be met with overwhelming violence. So, which is it? Either military force is counterproductive, in which case threatening it is empty theater, or it's effective, in which case the critique of Israel collapses. You can't have it both ways, and Vance seems perfectly comfortable having it both ways.
That's the incoherence. Rubio's worldview doesn't have that problem. For him, force and diplomacy aren't opposites. They're tools on a spectrum, and the calibration matters. His position is that Iran only negotiates seriously when it's under genuine pressure, sanctions that actually bite, credible military threats, a demonstrated willingness to strike their proxy infrastructure. Absent that pressure, diplomacy becomes a mechanism for Iran to run out the clock.
Which is why the Operation Epic Fury reports from earlier this year are so significant. The U.S. military has been drawing up contingency plans for strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. That's not a routine planning exercise. Those plans always exist in some form. The fact that it leaked, that it has a name, that it's being discussed as a live option rather than a theoretical one, that tells you the internal debate is real and the stakes are existential.
Rubio's public statement suggests he'd support those strikes if negotiations collapse. Vance, by contrast, has expressed skepticism about what he calls another Middle Eastern war. So you have the vice president warning against military entanglement while the secretary of state is signaling that military options need to remain on the table. That's not a minor policy disagreement. That's a fundamental divide about whether the United States is willing to use force to prevent a nuclear Iran.
Trump is in the middle, wanting the deal. Wanting the photo op. Wanting to say he achieved what nobody else could. The question is whether Rubio's hawkishness constrains Trump's deal, making instincts, or whether Trump overrides him entirely. And if Trump overrides him, does Rubio stay quiet, or does he break?
That brings us to 2028. Because every calculation Rubio makes right now has to be read through the lens of his own presidential ambitions. If Trump signs a deal that Rubio believes is dangerous, and Rubio stays silent, he owns that deal for the rest of his career. If he resigns in protest, he becomes a profile encouraged to the hawkish wing of the party. But he burns his relationship with Trump, and possibly with a significant chunk of the base.
The body language tells might be his way of threading that needle. He doesn't say anything disloyal. He doesn't publicly break. But anyone watching closely can see that he's not on board. The donors see it. The foreign policy establishment sees it. The primary voters who will matter in 2028 see it. He's positioning himself as the serious one, the one who understood the threat when others were chasing a deal.
Here's the thing Daniel picked up on that a lot of DC analysts miss. Rubio can name the proxies, not just in a prepared speech, in an off-the-cuff moment on the tarmac. Hezbollah's operational status in Lebanon, Hamas's reconstruction efforts in Gaza, the Houthis' maritime capabilities, the Shia militias in Iraq and Syria that answer to the Quds force, not to Baghdad or Damascus. That granular knowledge is absent from Vance's public statements. Vance talks about violence in the abstract, violence begetting violence, the limits of military force. Rubio talks about specific armed groups with specific capabilities and specific Iranian handlers.
If you're sitting in Jerusalem, watching this from a country that lives inside the range of those proxies, the difference between abstract philosophy and granular knowledge isn't academic. It's the difference between someone who understands the threat and someone who's still working out what he thinks about it.
The proxies are the entire game. Iran's nuclear program gets the headlines, but the proxy network is how Iran has expanded its influence from Yemen to Lebanon without triggering a full-scale war that would invite devastating retaliation. Every Hezbollah rocket, every Houthi drone, every Shia militia attack on U.S. forces, those are calibrated to stay below the threshold of major war while steadily advancing Iranian interests. Rubio understands that architecture. And his critique of any nuclear deal is that it leaves that architecture completely intact.
When the deal framework separates the nuclear file from the proxy file, which every proposed framework has done, Rubio sees that as a fatal flaw. Iran gets sanctions relief, gets legitimacy, gets access to the global financial system, and keeps its asymmetric warfare machine running at full capacity. From his perspective, that's not a deal. That's a surrender dressed up as diplomacy.
What does all this mean for someone trying to track where this is actually heading? Because that's what Daniel's really asking. Not just who Rubio is, but how to read the signals in real time.
The simplest heuristic is to watch Rubio's face. If he starts looking visibly uncomfortable in joint appearances, more lip compression, more averted gaze, it means the administration is moving toward a deal he considers dangerous. If he goes quiet entirely, that's an even stronger signal. A silent Rubio is either a sidelined Rubio or a Rubio who's calculating his exit.
If he starts speaking more, not less, If he gives more interviews like the Air Force One moment, naming proxies, framing Iran as inherently untrustworthy, that's him trying to shape the outcome from inside. He's using public statements to constrain the deal parameters, to make it harder for Trump to accept terms that Rubio believes are naive.
The internal contradictions aren't a bug in this administration's Iran policy. They're the defining feature. You've got a president who wants a signature achievement, a vice president who can't decide whether force is futile or necessary, and a secretary of state who thinks the entire negotiating framework is built on a misunderstanding of the adversary. That's not a coherent policy process. That's three worldviews in sustained collision.
Which makes Rubio the single most important figure to watch. Not because he'll necessarily win the internal debate, Trump is still Trump, and Trump wants the deal. But because Rubio's position, if he chooses to fight for it, could determine whether the deal that emerges has any teeth, or whether it collapses entirely and we end up with Operation Epic Fury moving from contingency planning to execution.
For anyone outside the Beltway trying to understand this, Rubio's Cuban-American background isn't a footnote, it's the explanation. He's not a generic hawk who read some think tank papers and decided Iran was a threat. He's someone whose entire political consciousness was formed in a community that learned, through direct experience, that diplomatic engagement with revolutionary regimes can be a form of surrender. That's not abstract strategic analysis for him. It's family history.
Foreign policy always looks like it's driven by grand strategy and national interest calculations. And some of it is. But it's also driven by the specific biographies of the specific people in the room. Rubio's father poured drinks behind a bar in Miami because a revolutionary movement took his country. That shapes how a man sees the world. It shapes what he's willing to accept in a negotiation. And right now, it's shaping whether the United States makes a deal with Iran, or prepares for something much worse.
One final thought on this, and it's the thing that's been sitting with me since Daniel sent the prompt. The most interesting political drama in Washington right now isn't between the United States and Iran. It's between three men in the same administration who have fundamentally incompatible theories of how the world works. Trump sees a transaction waiting to happen. Vance sees a philosophical puzzle he hasn't solved yet. And Rubio sees an existential threat that cannot be bargained with. They're all sitting on the same side of the table, but they're playing three different games.
The negotiation's outcome may ultimately depend less on what happens in the room with the Iranians than on which of those three men wins the argument with the other two. If Trump's instinct for the deal prevails, we get a framework that Rubio almost certainly believes is dangerous. If Rubio's hawkishness prevails, the deal collapses and we're looking at Operation Epic Fury moving from contingency to reality. If Vance's muddled middle holds, well, that's probably just paralysis, which is its own kind of outcome.
The question Daniel's going to be watching from Jerusalem is the same one we're left with. Will Rubio's conviction override Trump's deal-making instincts, or will the Secretary of State end up implementing a policy he doesn't believe in? The answer probably comes in the next few months. Watch his face.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, linguists studying Tuyuka, a language spoken in the Amazon, discovered it requires speakers to grammatically mark how they know what they're saying, a system called evidentiality marking. Every sentence carries a suffix indicating whether the information was seen firsthand, heard from someone else, or inferred. You cannot speak Tuyuka without revealing your source.
Every sentence is a citation. That's actually useful.
Imagine if political interviews worked that way. Iran is the master of genocide. I saw it with my own eyes. We're going to make a great deal. I heard it from a guy. Actually, maybe that would clarify things.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own questions about foreign policy, body language, or anything else that's been rattling around your head, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everything.
For Korn, I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep,
The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.